Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 15th, 1998. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Cheryl Ney. Session number is 98-7 and is titled Women Doing Genetics Research, The Life and Work of Dr. Barbara McClintock. Let's listen in.
My name is Cheryl Ney. I'm a chemistry professor at Capital University, which is one of the 29 ELCA colleges in Columbus, Ohio. So please, since we're small, we can have a more informal, more conversation here. So at any point, if you have a question or if you want to stop talking about something, let's do that, all right? Sometimes I'm trained as a scientist, and so we have this real agenda, I guess. So really, if there's a particular point that you'd like to stop and ponder, we can do that. The title of today's session is Women Doing Genetics Research, and we're going to use the life and work of Barbara McClintock as our exemplar in thinking about this. I was in the session, the forum last night, I don't know how many of you attended the forum last night, where we had people from really different cultures talking about God, and while everyone's sitting there thinking about God, I was thinking about science. Mm-hmm. So I think today sort of ties into that, and really ask the question, what happens when science opens up and you begin to get more diverse cultural representation in science? And I think the case of women in science is a good example of the possibility. So that's what I'm thinking of as we move through the session today. So I just have a couple points I want to look at here to kind of set up the video that I have, a 19-minute video on the life and times of Barbara McClintock. And I think if I can just provide some background, that I think your experience of watching the video will be enriched. Right. So really, today's session really comes out of a burgeoning new field, and it's called the field of gender and science, believe it or not. It actually has a title. We have a small set of works in this new field, and it does cover, at this point in its young history, three areas. The first being the history of women in science. There's been a lot done in the last 30 years about this. Another aspect of this field is to look at the current status of women and girls in science. So we look at statistics, we look at education, and we look at how families are dealing with husbands and wives working and that sort of thing. Another important area is to think about how science shapes our ideas of gender, and I'll have an example of that for you today. So the first point to start with is we go into this field of gender and science, and I want to move focus mainly over here in this part of the field, the history of women in science. The first thing to realize is that there is a history of women in science. And it goes back a long, long time. This is a nice volume. Starts in antiquity. Antiquity through the 19th century. It's called Hypatia's Heritage. Just a couple of examples I can give you out of this. This book is nice because it tells us that Plato had a mother. And that she taught him mathematics. Right, so there's some evidence for that here. Another example I like is about 11th century Italian female physician. Her name was Trotula, who wrote a treatise that was used until the 16th century. It was such a remarkable piece of work. However, very often when it was recopied by hand, you know, no Xerox machines back then, the name Trotula became Trotus, which was sort of the male. And so for a long time, it's been more recently that scholars have thought of Trotula as a male instead of a female. So there is a rich history. There is even a rich history of women in science in the United States. And so I thought I would introduce you to that by showing you, oh boy, now I have to erase everything, by showing you the foreword to the first volume that we have about the history of women in science in the U.S. This is a book written by Dr. Margaret Rossiter. She's this Harvard-trained historian, all right? So she's sort of this, you know, as you can imagine, being trained at Harvard in history, right? This is how she is. And she started out classically trained in the area of history of science. And then something happens to her in her career about the 1970s, which I wanted to show you. This comes from her first book. Let's see, I want to start right here. I can still recall my astonishment when I discovered in 1972, not that long ago, some women's entries in the old American Men of Science directories. And when I read biographies of several scientists in the then new notable American women, Here were people who had been present at many of the familiar places and events, but who were totally unknown, even to those of us well-versed in the history of American science. I felt like a modern Alice who had fallen down a rabbit hole into a wonderland of the history of science that was familiar in some ways, but distorted and alien in many others. Learning more about these women and bringing their stories into closer connection with the rest of the history of this period became a compelling and absorbing intellectual task. So here we have someone who's classically trained, never heard of women in science, and she kind of just happens upon it herself. She became so absorbed in the task that she's now written two volumes. So we have the history of U.S. women in science from the 1800s through the 1950s. She's the kind of historian who went back to the literature. So you read her notes. Her notes are about a third of the size of her book. She's gone back into these libraries, and she's had to blow off the dust of these old scientific journals, and she has really dug deep and found that we indeed have a history of women in science. Because we have a history of women in science, we now have ways to think about the history of women in science. It's moved beyond just reporting. All right, I could stand here and talk about stories and stories and stories, but we know we have so many stories now that we have a way to critically analyze the life and times of the life and work of women in science. And there are two tools that I wanted to give you today to help you enter into this field so that you can also dig things out yourself. The first tool that Margaret Rossler developed was the idea of looking for the barriers and the strategies that women used. Right? So we try to analyze the barriers that women face, both culturally and internally, and you look at their lives and try to figure out how they overcome barriers. Now, this is not unique to science, of course. We can do this in any field. But she's done enough work that she actually uses this as a theme for her first volume. Right? And so we'll use that tool today as we look at this video. I'm going to ask you to tell me something about the barriers that you hear in Barbara McClintock's life as we look at her story. But I did want to show you one cultural barrier that certainly Barbara McClintock had to deal with that we have less and less to deal with. Right? And that's a barrier that comes actually from science itself, and that it trickles down into our social discussion and shapes our social ideas. And I like to choose this one because it does come out of science. Let me just say a word about it. I'm taking it from this book, The Less Noble Sex. This is the scientific, religious, and philosophical conceptions of women's nature. All right, so this book is lovely because it tells us what religious people have thought about women over the years, what philosophers have philosophized about women's natures over the years, and what science itself has said about women's nature over the years. And that's by Nancy Twana. Barbara McClintock was born in 1902, so we're at turn of the century, right? And there was a particular idea floating in culture around this time that I want to share with you, and I think this captures it pretty nicely. Let me just move this up here. I could bring the screen down, couldn't I? But that would be pretty clever. What happened in science around this time, all right, so we're talking about late 1800s. What happened in science around this time is they applied the idea of the conservation of energy to human bodies. Okay, and what they said was that all the energy you have is all the energy you're going to get. All right, so that was one idea. And then, of course, since that's all the energy you have, it's only going to go to the most important organs. So what are the most important organs for men? Right, their brains. And their reproductive organs, and for females, of course, it would be the reverse, right? All right. So here goes the theory. Famous physical chemist used his work a lot, von Helmholtz, and it's an application by Spencer. According to him, each body forms a closed system which contains only a finite amount of energy. Since the functioning of each organ requires expenditure of energy, any undue demand placed on one organ inevitably depletes some other. So you can see what's going to happen. The organs of the body were thus seen as competing for limited resources. The central battle, according to this theory, was between the brain and the reproductive organs, two of the most powerful organs of the human body. It was believed that the brain could be developed only at the expense of the reproductive organs. this theory would then apply to the traditional view that reproduction is central to women's biological life, while rationality is central to man's being. Men were warned of the dangers of sexual indulgence, for channeling energy to the sexual organs would use up energy needed to develop their intellectual abilities. Men were urged to cultivate their brains in order to control the power of their sexual drives, and were warned of the dangers of debilitating their energy by unnecessarily spending their seed. Women, on the other hand, were told that they must ensure the development of their reproductive organs, since procreation was their function and goal in life. Add to this the neo-Darwinian view that the female contributes far greater energy to reproduction than does the male, and the inescapable conclusion was that women's developmental energy must be devoted to reproduction at the expense of her intellectual abilities. Now, when I do this with sophomores in college, they laugh. It's really hysterically funny. You know? It is funny looking back. But unfortunately, this idea had a tremendous impact on the education of women. There was a very famous Harvard physician who took this kind of idea and wrote books that were reprinted over and over again about educating girls. And the idea was that you shouldn't send women to schools where they're going to have to use their brains, because that was going to affect their future reproduction. So, you know, we laugh, but if you were a girl back then, it wouldn't have been very funny, right? You'd be learning to embroider is what you'd be learning to do, right? So this is the kind of times that Barbara McClintock kind of came into. Now, it turns out her parents were forward-thinking. Her dad was a minister, actually. And so they really tried to encourage her development. But she was living in a culture which definitely did not want to encourage her development. And her neighbors would always harass her for wearing pantaloons instead of dresses and, you know, things like that. So that kind of gives us an example of a social/scientific barrier that. So I think it's interesting, you know, if this happened in the past, what we use history for is a guide, right? Well, what goes on today? What kind of scientific ideas permeate into our culture and thereby affect us? I think that's a really interesting question to think about. Questions or comments about this? Have people heard of these kinds of scientific ideas before? About how science actually shapes our ideas about men and women? It's a little astonishing when it gets into public policy and thereby influences the education of women and girls for a long time. Let me just give you another analytical tool for which we can use to analyze McClintock's life, and that is the idea we know enough now that scholars are beginning to write about unique contributions that women are making in science. Right, we mean, you know, science as sort of our stereotypical kind of the normalized aspects of science. So I don't mean to exclude any men who may be on the fringe. All right, unfortunately, they haven't been studied. I do know that there are men on the fringe. I've seen them walk away from science because of the hostile environments they experience. But they haven't been studied yet. But we do have enough knowledge about women that we can begin to ask the question, are they making unique contributions? And there does seem to be a literature on that. So I just wanted to spend a few minutes giving you some examples of this. There are three major areas right now where people are talking about the unique contributions of women. One is in their choice of research subject. Women, like everybody, are going to study what they're interested in, right? So if you open up science to different perspectives, right, what you're doing then is opening up the ability to ask different kinds of questions. All right? And the best example, of course, that we have is the area of women's health. Right? Some of us now live long enough that we know that didn't even used to be a subspecialty, right? But now there are a few forward-thinking medical schools that actually have women's health as a subspecialty, and that really can be thought of as a result of bringing more and more women into the field. I think there are lots of other examples. Can anybody think of another example in science where you have I can think of another good one, which actually ties into the next one. And that is another McClintock, in no relation, Martha McClintock. When she was a student at Wellesley, which is a women's college, she was an undergrad, she wanted to know why all the women's menstrual cycles in her dorm synchronized, right? So she went off, and as an undergraduate, she went off and did a study, which got published in a very prominent journal in Nature. And now she's still working in that area, and just recently has shown that there is a pheromone, a molecule that women emit to synchronize things. Right? So there she was following her own research. Right? So we can see that a science that opens up perspectives, that brings more different kinds of people into science, we're going to get more questions asked. Another example of a unique contribution comes in the way of working their methods, right? As you might suspect, when you're socialized in certain ways or you have certain experiences or certain perspectives, you work in particular ways. And so now we know enough about women's lives to know that they're bringing that into science. Let's see, I'll give you a couple quick examples. There was a very famous experiment done in the 40s. The Hershey and Chase experiment, I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was the experiment that let us know that DNA is the material of heredity. One of the key experiments. Let's see, Hershey was the famous scientist who went on to get the Nobel Prize, male scientist who went on to get the Nobel Prize for his work. Martha Chase is a technician in his lab who had a neighbor, I think her name was Betty. I forget her last name, I think it was, I don't know. Her name is in the literature, it's just what I forgot. And Martha is talking to her friend Betty about this experiment that they're working on, and Betty says, "Here, why don't you try my warring blender?" So Martha takes Betty's warring blender into the laboratory, and it turns out that the use of that warring blender was critical for that particular experiment. Right, so there we have a good example of just bringing your stuff from the lab and using it to work with. I had a student last semester who tried to track down something about Martha Chase's life, and we just couldn't get very far, which was kind of interesting. She's played a part of this critical experiment. Lots of things I offered Hershey, by the way. Let's think of another example. Martha McClintock has another example. After she did this Wellesley study, she went on to become what they call a biopsychologist. Apparently, it was a new field, and she studied rats. And she was interested in studying the social behavior of rats. And she noticed that the dominant way to study rats was to do what? To take a white male rat. It happens they're white males. Put them in a metal cage all by themselves, right? And then introduce them to each other. So she had the great idea of building these large cages in her laboratory that had natural habitats. And then out of that, you begin to study, right? So it's like, it was really a sort of a paradigm shift apparently in the rat field. To think about studying social behavior with groups of rats. Let's see, we'll also get an example of this when we look at Barbara McClintock's work, and I'll tell you about that in a moment. She does really bring a different way of working, and we'll talk about that. The final area in which we begin to see how different perspectives contribute to science is in the area of, I would call it, theory making or idea generation. And the way to get at this is through language, that we know that the words that we use, the metaphors that we use, really embed our values, our worldview, our snuck into our words and our metaphors. And what we begin to see is that women can bring different words and metaphors. I have a favorite from my own field. I'm a chemist, and the way reactions are commonly described, the way chemical reactions are commonly described in chemistry is that molecules come together in these violent collisions, right? Now, I don't know if you've been watching the news, local news lately, but in my city, they show us all the time these smashed cars and these huge stuff, this idea of collision is really, it's a particular way of thinking about this event. Whereas what's happening in my field is as textbook authors begin to rewrite things, we think about, molecules coming together and what happens when molecules come together. And that's kind of a different way of conceiving what goes on in the test tube in terms of these molecules. Now, I don't want to say it's bad to use the idea of collision. It certainly has gotten chemistry very far, right? The chemistry that we have is very effective. My point is that if we have different people using different metaphors to shape their research, we're going to get more. Right? We're going to get enriched by that experience. So we can talk more about that particular one, but I don't think I'll go any further with it. So I'm happy to report that we're beginning to see the impact of bringing different perspectives in science, and I think this is good. That what we say in the field of gender and science or women in science is what's good for women is also good for men. That, as I said, I know that there are men on the margins, and you know they experience similar things. And so what's going to happen here is, we hope anyway, the knowledge is going to get richer. All right, so there now you have two critical tools that you can use when we look at the tape on Barbara McClintock's life. We're going to watch for barriers and strategies, and we're going to see if you can tease out the uniqueness of her work. So let me just narrow in now on our subject and give you some background. All right. First of all, one of the most important things to remember about Barbara McClintock is she got a Nobel Prize. Okay? So this means that she was very effective with what she did. So not only can we say that she did things differently, but she did things effectively by the community standards. All right? So we don't have to have the debate about, well, you can't really work her way because we don't know if it's going to be effective or not. Yes, we know that what she did was very effective. So it's very important to understand that she got a Nobel Prize for her work, so that means her work was good. Okay? And she got the prize in 83, I think. She got it in the 80s for work that she'd done in the 40s and 50s. So this was a real case where there were some... it's a very sort of a complicated story about why she didn't get the prize. Really, it was a lack of understanding, and part of the reason why there was a lack of understanding was the times that she was working in. So let me just share with you a little bit about that. This period of scientific history is a period which is dominated by an idea called reductionism, where there is this tremendous push in both chemistry and biology to try to reduce human life to its parts. Right? And the idea is, just like a watchmaker, right? You can, you know, take apart that watch, and you know what each part does, and then you can put it back together, and you got a watch that works, right? So it was the same idea in science of this period, that if we could reduce life to its simplest, most fundamental pieces, then we could put them all together, and we'd have life, right? In fact, this whole field was... many people in this field at this time report that they were influenced by a book written by a physicist, Erwin Schrödinger. He's one of the quantum physicists of the time, who wrote this tiny book in the late 30s called What is Life? And what he was trying to do there was, he was trying to take the ideas from physics, because they had just had, I mean, it was a great time in physics in this country at the turn of the century, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, they got the problem of the duality, the wave-particle duality of nature kind of figured out, and they got the quantum theory, you know, so they were riding high that their methods of reductionism were, you know, could lead to this powerful atom bomb, powerful understanding, right? And so these physicists, many of them began to move into biological sciences. And they had a very clear idea about what they were going to do. They were going to reduce life. Right? And so during this period, they're interested in, these kinds of scientists are interested in bacteria and viruses. Because these are teeny tiny little organisms, there's not much to them, they're not very complicated. And this work really put people on the hot pursuit of understanding DNA. All right, so here, a lot of work is done in this period to kind of reduce life to DNA. Right? What else can I say about reductionism? So they're narrowing in on DNA. They think it's so important, they call it the master molecule. right? Now think of, you know, what kind of worldview comes out of the idea of labeling a molecule the mass of the molecule, right? So we have over here DNA is the master molecule, and we get something called the central dogma. You know, I can't think of another area of biology or even chemistry that has a dogma, right? And this central dogma says that the master molecule controls the production of proteins in cells, and here's where you get cell function. And I've even seen in a 50s version of the biochemistry text that I use, these proteins were described as workhorses. Now, you know, there's not too many of us that know what a workhorse is anymore. When I used to describe this idea in the early 80s, I said, I like to kind of turn it around and call it the proteins, the house wives of the cell. I took care of it. But as we moved into the late 80s, my students, not a single one of them had a mother who stayed at home, you know, so there goes that metaphor. But you can see what this, you can read the times in the theory, right? You can see that you talk about a molecule as a master molecule because that's the kind of life that you're leading. You know, you can see Beaver Cleaver and show us that, you know, make room for daddy and all that kind of stuff, right? It's kind of a similar thing. So that's the period that Barbara McClintock's working with. Now she, quite in contrast to these folks, as you'll see in the video, is working with maize, which is complicated, much more complicated than bacteria. It's made more complicated by the fact that it's not ordinary corn, right? That maize is that Indian corn, the stuff with all the colors on the kernels. So, you know, she's not working with a simple tiny organism. She's working with a much more complicated organism. And she's a much more holistic thinker, so she's not interested in reductionism. What she does with her mind is she likes to see the whole, you know? She's not trying to get down and just focus on an individual molecule. So these kinds of things made it very difficult for her work to be accepted. That she's working with a different organism, a lot of people didn't understand this organism, and she just kind of thinks in a different way. And so this made it really, really difficult. We've got to show the video, but let me just say one more thing to help you understand. So her work was extremely unique. Let me just say one more word about that, and then I'll tell you this other thing. And that is, what she discovers is that the master is mutable. That is, the people who had the idea of DNA as the master molecule, you know, you think of it static, you know, it's kind of this, you know, it's unchangeable, unmovable. What she discovers is that the DNA itself moves around, it changes. And this, you know, is just something that people can't handle. So that's really, the DNA moves around. That's really her fundamental piece of work. That in itself is astonishing. We could stop with that. But what's even more astonishing is how she worked. And let me just say one word about that, because the video doesn't do a very good job in telling us about that for particular reasons, I'm sure. It's quite clear from interviewing her as the author of her biography has done that she works really differently than scientists of her times or how we train scientists today. And that is that she didn't think of pure rationality as being something that you could take outside yourself. That is, when you go into the lab and you work, or when you're out in the cornfield and you're working, it's you who's out there. You can't take away your biases. You can't take away your emotions from your work and what have you. And the one emotion that's really phenomenal in McClintock is empathy. That she cares very much about her corn. She apparently was renowned for the fact that she could tell you the life history of any one of the corn plants in her field. That she had this phenomenal connectedness with her corn. So she used the value of empathy to drive her curiosity. Right? It didn't make her less rational to care about what she was studying. In fact, it hyped up her ability to work with this corn. It sort of hyped up her rationality instead of took away from her rationality. All right, so it's quite a different way of working. And if we have time at the end here, I'll show you a little bit deeper about how that empathy works. Right now, I've talked about her all week, and so I should say that even though she was using emotion in her work, she was still rational. She worked very hard. All right, it didn't slow her down. What her empathy did was really sort of drive her passion and her research pursuit. All right, so with that, why don't we turn to the video here so that you can, now you're experts in gender and science. You can use barriers and strategies, and you can kind of try to get this unique contributions thing. And I think we've saved enough time so that we can talk a little bit here. Would you hit the light at the back? Can we just focus on this set over here? It would be helpful to have both of them on. So look for barriers and strategies and her unique contribution. Suggest itself as to how to proceed, they are the ones that are going to be proceed along that line. We are going to have, I think, many revolutions.
Barbara McClintock was involved in many scientific revolutions before she won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1983. In fact, her life in many ways traced the enormous advances in biology that had taken place since the turn of the century. Her chosen field of study, genetics, wasn't much older than she was, and during her life it had changed beyond all recognition as scientists probed ever deeper into the mysteries of life. Nonetheless, Barbara McClintock had stayed in the forefront of her field, and often in advance of it. In fact, she was so far ahead of her contemporaries that for decades she had been dismissed as an eccentric, and her findings and interpretations had been rejected. She didn't allow this to deter her, but continued her research until the rest of biology at last caught up. The award of the Nobel Prize finally acknowledged her position as one of the leading scientists of the century, but it brought with it unwelcome distractions.
If you want to know the truth, I don't have publicity. I don't have my time to give up towards me. And I knew it would be that. So I had and at my age, it's quite short.
Even as a child, Barbara McClintock was encouraged to be herself, to the point of being allowed to miss school if she didn't like her teacher. This didn't seem to hurt her education, and in 1919, she enrolled at Cornell University. She wanted to join the Department of Plant Breeding and Genetics, but it was not yet a time of full equality for women, and that department was still open only to men. Barbara McClintock joined the botany department instead. She soon proved herself to be one of the best students, and certainly one of the most involved.
I was inclined to take the final in the course, everybody was. And I was so anxious to save the question because I knew there was nothing they were going to ask me that I wouldn't be able to answer. And I was just very eager to see it. So I went in and they gave out them what they call notebooks for the exam books. And there you had to put your name on it after you got there. Well, I was so anxious to see what the questions were that I did put my name on it. I just started writing right away and I enjoyed it and I got through very fast. And then I turned it over and put my name on it. I couldn't remember it. And I just couldn't dare ask anybody adjacent to me what my name was. I was the after about 20 minutes, it finally came.
Throughout her life, Barbara McClintock always did what she wanted to do, what she knew to be right, rather than what was expected of her. At college, that included playing tennis, missing lectures to go ice skating, and in the evenings, playing banjo in a jazz band. But her work was her first priority, and one by one, those other pursuits got left behind as she was drawn deeper and deeper into the science. It was in 1921, in her junior year, that she took her first course in genetics.
Genetics at that time was a very young subject and not totally accepted by many people. At Cornell, there was only one course for undergraduates, and that was in the Department of Plant Breeding in the Agriculture College. At the same time I was doing that, I was taking a course in chromosomes.
Those courses led her into graduate work, and she rapidly demonstrated her extraordinary ability. Her advisor had been trying for years to identify the chromosomes in a type of corn called maize. McClintock managed to do it in a very short time. Her whole field of research was blossoming, and she soon became a member of a group of the leading young researchers working on the genetics of maize. The group included George Beadle, a Nobel laureate-to-be, and Marcus Rose, who was also to become a leading figure in genetics.
Well, we got together and began to work and talk, and then others and then other people involved in the maize work began to join us, so we had a very, very active group working in a brand new field. So by 1931 or so, we had accomplished quite a lot.
In that year, 1931, McClintock published research which proved for the first time that the chromosomes form the basis of inheritance, one of the cornerstones of modern experimental genetics. She was celebrated as a leading light in her field, but in the 1930s, women were not easily accepted into the scientific establishment. In spite of her achievements, Barbara McClintock could not get a job. She refused to compromise by taking a teaching post and found her own ways to continue her work. After 9 years, in 1941, she was offered a junior researcher's job at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory in Long Island, New York. She gratefully accepted it and repaid them by working there for the rest of her career. Marcus Rose was also at Cold Spring Harbor, and together they continued their studies of plants, in particular, maize. At that time, maize was one of the most studied organisms of classical genetics, but it had two main drawbacks. It was highly complex, and it took a long time to breed and raise each successive generation. Together, these factors made it particularly inappropriate for studying the chemical basis of heredity, and it was in this direction that genetics research was turning. In 1944, it was shown that DNA formed the material basis of inheritance. A scientific revolution followed as genetics entered the era of molecular biology. The subjects studied were bacteria and viruses, simple organisms with small amounts of genetic material and short life cycles, which meant that experiments could be performed quickly. Classical genetics techniques and disciplines were ignored, as those of biochemistry, X-ray crystallography, microbiology, and physics were adopted. In 1953, Crick and Watson unraveled the chemistry of the DNA double helix, and the central dogma was born. This maintains that the DNA controls the forms and functions of the organism. The genetic code is transcribed into RNA and then translated into protein. The genetic information flows from the DNA to the protein and in one direction only. The genetic material, the DNA, is the starting point and is uninfluenced by factors such as the environment. It was simple, clear, and precise. Most geneticists began to think that they had answered all of the most interesting questions. Not Barbara McClintock. She felt that most of the interesting questions hadn't even been asked yet. Using the simple techniques of observation and analysis, she was on the verge of making one of the great discoveries in modern genetics. First, she noticed unusual patches of color in maize leaves and kernels. Patches of cells in which the genes that control color were being expressed in a way that was different from the cells around them.
I was very curious about this. This was nothing I put it on. Something was happening to change the action of the gene.
Eventually, she came to the conclusion that structural genes, the genes which code for proteins, and in this case determine the color of the kernel or leaf, could be turned on and off by other genes which lie adjacent to them on the chromosome. In the plant she was studying, the genes were turned off by a break or dissociation in the chromosome. So she called the genes which controlled this dissociators, DS. For McClintock, the dissociator gene was a controlling element. She also found that these controlling elements were themselves turned on and off by other genes which she called activators, AC, and which were situated on a completely different part of the chromosome from the dissociator and structural genes. This is where things got complicated. McClintock also discovered two more things which couldn't be explained by any of the theories then current. Firstly, the effect of the activator gene varied according to how many copies of it there were, and this could change from cell to cell. Secondly, there were other genes that were controlled by the activator, and most surprisingly, these were also controlled by the single controlling element. The only way that she could explain these findings was that pieces of DNA were moving around the genome, relocating themselves within the chromosomes. Copies of the activator gene must have been moving from chromosome to chromosome, changing its potency. And the controlling element could also change its place in the chromosome, turning any one of a number of genes on or off. McClintock called this movement transposition. This whole new system of genetic control raised another important question, as it seemed that genes could be turned on and off at precise times. How was this actually done? The only answer seemed to be that factors outside the chromosome were having some effect, that information was passing from the environment to the genetic material, from protein to DNA. This contradicted the central dogma and was heresy to the molecular geneticists who found Barbara McClintock's work both idiosyncratic and obscure.
One man, I haven't seen for a long time, came in to see me, and the first thing he said, if Marcus Rhodes didn't tell me what you were doing was all right, I wouldn't believe a word you said. And later on, somewhat later, another person I knew quite well, he used to come up here a lot, he came in to see me. And he said, no, I understand you're doing something that's very strange, and I don't want to hear a word about it. Now, these were fun. I didn't bother me one bit.
Mays, as a subject for genetics research, had long since been relegated to the history books by the molecular biologists. This meant that they were completely unfamiliar with its biology and the classical techniques that McClintock was still using. They were baffled by both her thought processes and her conclusions, even though she found them transparently obvious.
There was no question in my mind that the information I had received was so strong that there was no way of drawing any other conclusion. Therefore, when you feel that strongly about something, you can't be turned off. Nobody can hurt you. You just go right on. Nobody can hurt you. And you don't even feel it.
But things were starting to change. In 1960, Jakob and Monod published their operon theory of gene control. They had discovered that certain genes were turned on by an operator gene, which itself was turned on and off by a regulator gene. Even though this was reminiscent of McClintock's activator and controlling elements, the scientific community still didn't fully accept her findings.
When gene regulation was first announced by Jacob Monod, people were so sure that that was all there was to it. That is, that if you know bacteria, you can explain an elephant. That didn't come out right in the long run. But that was accepted by many people. I think we have to go through phases where you clear one generalization and you find you have to go to another, and usually something shows what the other is going to be.
The generalizations of the central dogma were changed to include the Jakob and Monod findings, but McClintock was still out in the cold. Then it was discovered that pieces of DNA could move between bacteria carrying antibiotic resistance with them, and that viruses worked by inserting their genetic material into that of their hosts. Slowly, transposition came to be acknowledged as a reality, and after 30 years, the scientific world caught up with Barbara McClintock. She even had a lab at Cold Spring Harbor named after her. Finally, she had triumphed over the cynics, the disbelievers, and the disadvantages of being a woman in a man's world.
This has its difficulties with respect to job offers, but otherwise very simple. In fact, as I have very warm relationships with my colleagues over the years. I can tell you an experience I had with one of the graduate students when I was at Missouri. It's indeed, he was a very bright graduate student. And he was telling me one time how he couldn't stand the world. And he went on and on, and finally I stopped and I said, to whom are you talking to?
The news of the award of the Nobel Prize to Barbara McClintock was greeted with particular warmth by women around the world. But it was her scientific research, not her gender, that won her the highest accolade in the science. She herself thought that she was too much of a maverick to be a role model for other women, but she was still conscious of her responsibilities to them.
You have to be able to understand what it means to them. That's why I'm conforming. If it weren't for that, I wouldn't conform. I don't know if that even means anything. Because I'm just disappointed to them. And this has happened to me more than once with awards, you know, or with recognitions that came early meant that I had to stay whether I liked it or not. Because of them, I couldn't let them down. I can't do that now.
In her 70s, this video was made.
This presentation.
Questions, comments? Get to know a little bit about her. What about barriers and strategies? What do you think?
Nobody would give her a job.
Nobody would give her a job. She went for 9 years. She had to piece her research career together. She had friends, supporters in high places like in the Rockefeller Foundation and things like that, and they sort of helped her kind of stay alive until she got, you know, they pieced together grants for her until she got this job. And she was so focused on wanting to do research that she, you heard on the tape, didn't want to teach, because she knew that teaching would take her away from your research. And if any of you are teachers, you know how hard to keep a focus when you're teaching. So that was a barrier for her. Other things you saw?
Well, she originally wanted to be in a different department, but wasn't open, so she went to the botany department, I think it was.
Right. But sometimes, at least in this day and age, we don't think of barriers like that in universities, but there were all kinds of barriers. I have a colleague at Capital who's in social work. She must be maybe 10 years older than I was. She said that she wanted to be a veterinarian. And when she went to the vet school, they said, no women. I'm a social worker, he's a horsewoman. So, right, so just sort of institutional barriers. Yeah?
I thought it was interesting that she studied botany and chromosomes simultaneously, the two great tools that she put to work later on.
She did. She really came at a crossroads, and probably one of the sort of, you can think of as a strategy for her survival was that she was in this new field, bringing in this old classical genetics. So she just kind of hit it at a good moment. But that doesn't take away from her intelligence and her hard work.
Right, yeah. You mentioned that as soon as she, the professor or whatever was working with Mays, and he'd been trying to figure this out for a long time, and it said it didn't explain how, but she did it rather easily or fairly quickly, you know, so somehow she knew
she had an ability.
Yeah.
Well, the point I was making is it was as if she had pursued two disciplines, a double major, so to speak.
She was really noted for her talent with the microscope, and the way she talks about it to her biographer is, for example, they were trying to find chromosomes in this corn, a particular particular kind of corn, and nobody could find these chromosomes. And she knew that the chromosomes had to be there because there were chromosomes and other things. So she describes this experience she had. She went to the microscope, she couldn't see them. So she said, I went away. She said, I went and sat under the eucalyptus tree, and I got my mind ready. Like it went back, and I was able to see them. So she uses this idea of kind of getting inside the cells. She knew that it was supposed to be in there, you know, and so she kind of dove in and started looking around with what she considered to be the right state of mind. So she was a remarkable microscopist, I guess. Really remarkable. Other things. What about strategies? What do you see that sustains her in her early childhood? Did anybody catch that line about her parents?
Well, letting her not go to school if she didn't like the teacher.
Right. Her parents were mavericks themselves, and so I think that probably...
And she followed that through by skipping classes and doing the other things to get her mind in the right frame.
She has a remarkable focus. I love to show this tape to my students because anymore, you know, they come into college and they're working on jobs, and, you know, in some cases they come from single-parent families or, you know, troubled families, and so they take on, you know, the mantle of, you know, I've got to go home and take care of my mom, you know. So they come with all this busyness, and they don't have any focus. And I like to show this tape because, I mean, she reminds all of us, even me, you know, that if you really want to kind of dive in deep, you got to have a focus, you know, you got to know where you're headed, and she's remarkable. Maintaining that. Other barriers or strategies you see that... I have a question for you. I've never had the opportunity to have a group of women watch this tape. Do you believe her when she says, didn't bother me that they didn't listen to me? You know, she constantly, one time after, there's about three or four times on this tape where she says, doesn't bother me at all.
Couldn't feel the pain.
Couldn't feel the pain. Do you believe her?
No, maybe she got over it eventually, but it had to, when she was doing research that was so advanced over what everybody else was doing, it had to.
That's what I noticed in reading her book. When she first presented her results, they used to have these big summer meetings, kind of like Holman Village, in genetics at Cold Spring Harbor. And she was working there, so, you know, she was sort of like on staff there, and staff people were to present their work. The first time she presented her work, almost no one in the audience understood her. And she decided right then that she would never give a public talk there again. And she didn't. And she didn't publish in journals, she just published in the report at Cold Spring Harbor. So that tells me that at that time in her life, earlier in her life, she really got stung.
She might have had to get over that so she could get on with the research.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Chose not to focus there.
Right. She had enough internal, I think, strength that she could, it really helped her move on. There's another, her biographer, Dr. Evel Fox Keller, has another theory about her, and that is that apparently there's some kind of psychological theory that, you know, these geniuses, these stars, they're using their work to kind of replace what they don't have in their life. That Barbara McClintock's parents, while they were maverick, don't seem to be very loving. That they would, you know, kind of like Skinner, they would just let her, you know, they would tell her to go away and cry. You know, they wouldn't, you know. And so there's some, at least Dr. Fox Keller thinks that perhaps she's substituting, you know, for intimate relationships with human beings, she's got this very intimate relationship with nature. And in fact, she talks about how she's so connected to nature that, you know, sometimes she doesn't like to walk on grass. She worries that she's hurting, you know, that she's just so intimate with nature.
And has that brought her ridicule?
I think it did.
This empathy.
Right.
You can just hear the... Or you can see the eyes rolling, and I'm like, gosh, I can't believe this woman worrying about the feelings of the...
Of the grass, yeah. Or the corn, or what have you. So, yeah, I think in the 50s, particularly in the 50s. One nice connection that Fox Keller makes is that she's not the only scientist who's ever worked with empathy, with this idea that you have to have this connectedness that, you know, Einstein talks a lot about how... The best kind of science is a science that comes out of this feeling of oneness for the universe and what happened. But she's certainly the best example of being able to do it in biological sciences. So, other questions or comments?
Was she married?
No.
No children?
No children.
So all of her energies were in her mind.
Right.
Very intense developments. By choice, it was her choice.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a common model back then, you know, that, you know, if you wanted to be a woman in science, you were going to become a bride of the school. Instead of a bride of Christ, you became a bride of your institution. And you get this phenomenon, particularly at women's colleges, where you go as a woman student, you come back after you get your PhD, you stay there your whole life, then you retire to a cottage on the campus, and you get a building named after you. That was a very common model back then. And so it turns out that that's one thing that young women today still worry about. You know, am I going to be able to have a family and do science? And reassure them that they can strike a balance.
One of the things I wondered about, considering the time period, was Skinner's influence on her, and the fact that she was able to think that the DNA could change, and that was kind of Skinner's theory that you could change life by what was around, by the environment.
Oh, but, interesting.
So I was wondering how that kind of influence impacted her.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know who her circle of friends were, so I've never made that connection before. Yeah, so she was perfectly open to the idea that DNA could change.
And then we're going the other way nowadays. We're going back, and so it's sort of wondering what that's going to do with women in science. And
right. Good connection there. Other questions or comments?
I think the fact that she was educated, you know, East Coast, if she had grown up someplace else in the United States, would have made a difference?
Hard to say. Turn of the century. Certainly more is happening in industrial cities turn of the century, so there are more educational opportunities. So place is important, right? Who she is born to, right? Yeah. It's interesting, she had good friends out in California, so in this period where she couldn't find a job, she spent a lot of time out in California, even though she had a research position in Missouri. So can you imagine being a woman in science in Missouri around 1930, 1940? It was really, she didn't like it there, and that's what spurred her to get to Cold Spring Harbor, New York. So, well, it's been a good conversation. I'd like to end with thinking about the village theme this summer, which is Guide Our Feet. And in doing that, my connection is our feet, as we take journeys, are connected to us, our bodies. And often when we journey, we don't just use our feet, we use our minds, right? So we should ask for guidance of our minds as well as our feet. And then I think Barbara McClintock gives us a really nice example of how much more you could know if your heart, your passion is involved. So that's my connection. So when you see Guide Our Feet, I want you to think of guiding our heads as well and our hearts too. So, thank you. You can stop tape now.
Are you finding that there's becoming a balance of the sexes that you're in your classes?
Anymore, you know, there are more and more women undergraduates in science, and there's more and more women getting their PhDs. Like, I'm in chemistry. When I got my degree, 25% of the women, 25% of the degrees in chemistry went to women. Now it's 38. But what I see is happening is that women leave the field.
The jobs aren't there.
The jobs aren't there. The support for having families aren't there. But even worse than that is that, you know, you can't be yourself in this field. You have to be socialized to not have any empathy, to, you know, be. So I think the tragedy is that a lot of women are trained in science and they leave it. And that's bad for them, it's bad for science.
And there's still that glass ceiling. My daughter graduated from math a year and a half ago and refused to get a master's degree in that field because of the feelings from the undergraduate professors.
Yeah. The environment is still not good.
You gotta be tough to get through.
You have to be tough. Yeah, you have to be tough.
You have to be kind of like her and say, it's okay, my passion is going to drive me and not what
the external side.
Right. You know, and you know what I, to me, my fear is that now everyone, male and female, coming to college, they're not there to learn. They're there to get that job, and I see that worse than ever. You know, I teach nursing students sometimes, and in the 80s when I started teaching, you know, a great majority of them were there to help people, you know, which is not, sometimes it's not a good motive, but, you know. And now, you know, you talk to these women now, they know that it's a job that they'll be able to get money and have a family, and, you know, I don't hear any students saying, I want to be a nurse to help people anymore. It's strange. Yeah, you had a comment?
I think one thing that, well, one thing that contributes to that is just how the speed of information and all that sort of there really is this illusion that our species has all of a sudden changed and we can funnel feed out of the internet and you know just learn everything really fast. And so the lack of patience among students in general, I think is a consequence of the information technology really.
And sort of another consequence to that is that it's not true that you don't have to work hard to make new information, right? That the internet is easy access. You sit down, you plunk, and God, you know, you're in over your head. And what I see with students today is that they don't have the patience or the will, they don't have the passion to work hard. You can't learn these complicated ideas in science unless you're willing to work really hard. I mean, it's true in any field, but, you know, it used to be the standard idea was that, you know, all those students in science, oh, they work really hard.
You know? But also there's fewer and fewer producers of the art, the literature, and a lot more watchers. it's sort of like the change from live to televised performances. It's kind of...
But yeah, and I think I could push it even a little bit further to say that we live in an age where the message is anybody can do anything, right? Anybody can climb Mount Everest. Well, guess what? You need to be a highly trained mountain climber because you could find yourself in a bad situation. It's the same idea, you know, anybody can be a doctor. Well, it's not true. It's the people who have a particular way of looking, who are willing to work hard, you know, that we live in this sort of relativistic age where anybody can do anything and that really, with no effort. It's a little scary. But we survive somehow.
It's interesting for me to hear you say those things about college students because I'm a public school teacher. Do coordinating programs for gifted and talented students and find just as many underachieving gifted and talented students as there are underachievers in all realms. But the fact, too, that passion to work hard, they'd rather consume and be consumers of education than it is to, it's so much easier to say, I'm bored, meaning the teacher's boring and this isn't entertaining me and so I will give up because I consume and if it's not there, I can't. You know,
like
and then
you can't make contribution.
You right, and you do it to me, and it's really hard to find somebody who is willing to make the effort and go out there, and but then that looks when you're in fifth and sixth grade socially, that is not a good thing to do that either. So they're stuck between, you know.
I wonder how much of this is tied up with the idea of empathy, that, you know, back in the old days when we were living under this model where you said to be purely rational, that drive was already there, that, you know, we were building big bridges and bombs and, you know, engineering, and, you know, it was kind of an age in which we didn't have to have passion, kind of the times were kind of rolling us along, and now we live in an age where perhaps, people talk all the time about being relevant. Right, having relevant science activities. Well, I think that what that means is we need to give people a reason to want to study science, and that has to do with the empathy. So maybe with more empathy and hard work, we'll reinstill the idea of passion. So it's been a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Why did you say that? Why was it 30 years before she got her Nobel?
Well, part of it was this master molecule paradigm. But the other part is that she developed a particular vocabulary because she was working in isolation. So people couldn't understand her, they couldn't understand her organism. You know, there was just a whole set of complicating factors.
So people don't like to just say it was they had to catch up with her. You know, there was kind of a two-way street there, and that was really true. I heard her speak once, and when I was a graduate student, and I was like, you know, I knew that I wanted to understand what she had been doing. It really wasn't until I saw this video that I kind of figured out, you know, I understood her theory, because I certainly didn't understand it by talking to her.
She's very peculiar in that. That was
being a lecturer was not her thing.
It was not her thing.
It was one of her barriers.
It was one of her, a barrier she created herself.
Yes. Right. Unfortunately. Maybe it was protective.
It was, definitely. Well, it's been very good talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Enjoy your time in the village.
Thank you.
What if she would have wanted to show what she
did? That's an interesting. That is an interesting idea, that it was hers and hers alone. Yeah. She would let people, there were a couple of women in the labs close to hers, and they were part of her circle. And one of them describes how she learned to see as if Barbara McClintock were seeing, and that's how she learned to understand what she was doing right.